President talks to God. Do they drink near beer and go play golf while they pick which countries to invade, which Muslim souls still can be saved? I guess God just calls a spade when the president talks to God. When the president talks to God, does he ever think that maybe he's not? That voice is just inside his head.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his most recent book, Three Truths and a Lie, a memoir. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And since last week, with the opening of the Bush Library, the George W. Bush Library in Texas, attended by five living presidents, there's been some revisionist history about Bush's legacy. But given what's happening in for example, in Iraq, following our intervention at the very moment, Iraq appears to be poised to resume a civil war. And in Afghanistan, where the U.S. is going to withdraw in 2014, the country looks like it will revert to a civil war. So the sort of futility and failure of this seems to be fairly manifest.
Well, it's certainly a total failure from the perspective of imposing America's preferred solution upon both of these countries, and in the case of the Bush administration, establishing American geopolitical presence, which would continue to dominate for the rest of the century. That was really their grand ideal of, you know, permanent military presence in the heart of Central Asia and Afghanistan that could then intimidate Russia and China and help maintain American hegemony there. So that's all collapsed. On the other hand, I'd have to say that I think some of these internal struggles are essentially inevitable in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere until some kind of power resolution is reached among the parties. And I believe that the U.S. presence is counterproductive in nearly every case in allowing the natives and local peoples to really solve these things on their own, even if it's going to take a little bit of violence. Otherwise, it's just one more imposed pro-American dictator that that just enrages populations and gives us what we've got.
But it does seem, and I believe our allies have come to this conclusion, that the U.S. is a spent force in the Middle East. And, of course, the American public, I think, have quite rightly and wisely had enough. I think that's restraining any intervention in Syria, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bit of an extreme statement to say that the United States is a spent force, but the idea that the United States will be the dominant determinant of everything that goes on in the Middle East now really does represent a fading pipe dream and something that we should abandon as fast as possible. But obviously, the U.S. is a major power, militarily unrivaled, economically significant, diplomatically skilled, or let's say a huge diplomatic presence, even if often unskilled in the way it's conducted itself. So in that sense, I think the U.S. will be a player, but I hope it's going to be a modest player. And believe it or not, I think some of Obama's ideas, such as leading from behind or allowing regional players to take a greater role or simply allowing some of these things to unfold on their own is not a bad policy and a marked departure from where we've been before for the past 50 years or so.
But since George W. Bush, things got appreciably and precipitously worse, did they not? I mean, the intervention in these Muslim lands, which in many ways was right out of bin Laden's playbook, it feels like a hopeless fanatic goaded us into an endless war. And now we've got, you know, we've riled up a billion people.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you on that, Ian. if the goal and had been modest in either case of intervention, you could begin to maybe make a case for it. I think the case of Bush Sr. In the determination to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait was one such military intervention that was restricted in goals and quite successful. But the war to remake the world in our image, and especially not just democracy, but it was to establish American geopolitical power, unchallenged power in those areas, that was represented to me the huge overreach, and for which we're paying a bitter price now, and it's far from over.
And again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who is the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He's lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his most recent book, Three Truths and a Lie, a Memoir. So given that you can't undo history, and it would seem in retrospect that the less footprint we have in that part of the world, the better off we are and would have been. But it seems to me, though, that there's going to be, I don't know whether the worst is yet to come, but if my understanding is that even when the Assads fall, largely at the hands of what's being loosely called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the Al-Nusra Front seemed to be the most effective amongst the rebels. The assumption, I think, is it not that this will embolden the Sunni in the west in Anbar in Iraq and drive this fissure even deeper between the Sunni and the Shia? And at this point, some analysts have told me that Maliki is basically just the mayor of Baghdad, that the place is a tinderbox, and the Kurds haven't been getting any of their oil money. So isn't Iraq... aren't we going to see round two in Iraq?
I think Iraq has far from settled its sectarian problems between Shia and Sunni. But Ian, let's face it, any time you have an opening towards more democratic representative government in many of these states, you are going to have sectarian tensions are going to burst out into the open. These are unresolved power tensions. It's not that these people haven't lived together with more or less peacefully or with some good and bad moments for centuries and centuries, but the question of power has never been resolved on any kind of representative democratic basis. When you have Shia, who are the dominant element in Iraq, then you don't need to be very bright to see that any kind of democratic practice is going to bring them to predominant power and reduce Sunni power accordingly. Now, both Sunnis and Shia are going to have to learn to live with this. For the first time, living with it openly in a more mixed government. I think the Shia so far have, and especially Maliki, have acted first of all to shore up the power that they now have gained for the first time in history, in which they feel legitimated in having it, and they're very suspicious of Sunnis. I think that those Shiite policies have been unwise, and Maliki's policies have been very unwise, far too exclusive. But the Sunnis obviously would prefer to win back all power, even as a minority, as it was under Saddam Hussein. So a lot of shaking down here. Yes, I think people are going to need to do that on their own. And having American troops there does not improve the situation, because then each side simply deals with the United States as its card in the game, thereby pushing down the road any willingness to come to terms with each other.
Well, the good news, of course, is that Obama got the troops out. But surely the bad news is that rather than this country healing, outside forces are embroiling it in a kind of surrogate war between Iran and Saudi Arabia, and by extension Saudi Arabia, the United States, and Israel. Isn't that what's going on in that region?
Sure. Everybody has taken advantage of this to one extent or another. I think now Iraq is beginning to be more or less able, is as it were, fighting on its own. I don't see that external intervention as anywhere near as intense as it was earlier on. But yeah, the shakedown process, as I said earlier, is going to be take quite a bit of time. The Syrian angle is even more anguishing because, as you know, this is the ultimate no-win game, if I ever saw one, in the Middle East. Lose-lose on all sides, no matter who wins. It's essentially a loss for everybody else, and even the winner is unclear. So, at this point in the Syrian mess, it's very hard to know what Washington should do. If we intervene with military force, then we're falling right back into the same old trap, right in the middle of a civil war in which everybody plays us off against the others. And now, if no one intervenes in a situation that's gotten very ugly, it's no telling how much of a gain the extremist jihadists will make in that.
Well, we've got Libya as a kind of a precursor, don't we, in the sense that we brought down the dictator, but the place is in chaos. You've got these kind of Mad Max groups of militias driving around, encircling government ministries. Basically, it's a black hole, but Syria could be Libya, you know, on steroids.
Sure. In the case of Libya, the situation is extremely messy, but I don't think I wouldn't put it on a par with Syria in the sense that we are not witnessing right now massive sectarian Sunni Shiite clashes in quite the same way. Mm-hmm. Libya is going to have to shake down as well. When is the eastern part of Libya going to learn to live with the western part and to manage, administer the country wisely? I have no idea how long that's going to take, but they really have to do it on their own. Nobody else can do it for them. In Syria, the outcome now with jihadi forces coming in from the outside is really the perfect storm. And as I say, I think it's a no-win situation, but my gut instinct at this point tells me they sort of have to work it out on their own. But everyone has got a finger in the pie now.
Well, Graham Fuller, again, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council and former CIA station chief in Kabul, and his most recent book is Three Truths and a Lie, a Memoir. Just back to given the revisionist history about the Bush administration and even suggestions now from Republican pundits and Fox News that Bush kept us safe and Obama did not, referring to the Boston bombers, of course, selectively omitting 9/11 in that calculus. What about the possibility of a future blowback from our failed and futile interventions in Muslim lands, given that people are so riled up in those countries, particularly over the drones, etc.? Are we going to be visited by more and more of these kind of freelancers like the Boston bombers?
Well, you know, we've been talking about this for years, including you and I, on various at various stages as we've watched all of this unfold. I've never seen the Muslim world, and I've lived and worked there, as you noted, for nearly two decades. I've never seen it at such a high boil as it is now, and that's understandable when you've got war and military conflict in four or five countries in which the U.S. is involved in one degree or another in nearly every case. Then, of course, there is going to be blowback. If you will, and I've argued this before, that 9/11 was the blowback. I think most Americans or even Westerners tend to think of 9/11 as a blast out of the blue. Far from it. If you live in the Middle East, you can see this as really the logical culmination of decades of dissatisfaction with bitter dissatisfaction with American policies, and then going back earlier to British imperial policies. Of course, you know, if people are unhappy, it's not going to be the moderates that are going to rise up and rebel and strike. It's going to be the most radical force. So the question to me about 9/11 is, why didn't it happen earlier, or why should we assume that those forces are now spent or satisfied or feel that they've done what they wanted to do? Their number one goal, I viewed bin Laden and al-Qaeda as despicable. It's attack, direct attack, purely on civilians is an outrage, a criminal outrage, a moral outrage. But I don't think this kind of thing is going away as long as Muslims are still losing their lives in bombings, in bombings by the U.S., which are still continuing in Afghanistan, and now drones, which may have usually less people dead in each case, but still building up a huge legacy of anger and hatred that doesn't go away. Even if al-Qaeda has been largely diminished or destroyed in its headquarters in Afghanistan, as you say, it's the act alone bombers and terrorists that are the most scary, because they can't even be tracked institutionally.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Graham Fuller.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam, A World Without Islam, and his most recent book, Three Truths and a Lie, a Memoir. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the president's remarks today on the 150th anniversary of the National Academy of Sciences.
The newborn of the hammock rocks below a bolted sky that unlocks for the departing of the flocks from the shadow of an empire. God loves a triad, an articulate.